accession number 22065, Reel 7.
Dennis Avey, Reel 7.
7? Good heaven, I've been gabbling. Well, we happened to be on... I'm not sure what it was going to be, quite frankly. Whatever it was a concrete, big concrete building. And we were on concreting. And we used to get, as you know, it's 3 and 1. And sometimes 2 and 1, for good measure.
2 of what and 3 of what?
Sand and cement. But we used to put no end of sand in and very little cement. Unobtrusively, of course, it had been found out. And, of course, it used to be tipped in into the timber work, the timber framing. It used to be tipped in, so it was no concern. But when they took it away, it was green as anything, and it stayed green. You could have blown it over. And it was about a metre thick as well. That sort of thing. You know, it's stuff they couldn't put their finger on, really. Anybody can do sabotage, surreptitiously. But there's a way of doing it. It's not immediately you cut this and cut that and cut the t'other. But these sort of things, they're not very, you know, flamboyant at all, but they're very, very effective. Derricks we used to weaken as well. Used to take big bolts out of them that were tied up and put infinitely smaller bolts in and things like this. And you put the heavy loads on them, and of course the damn derricks used to collapse and what have you. Killed a lot of people as well. Oh, yeah. Well, this is it. When the devil drives, you know.
Was it important for your morale to do something like that?
Oh, absolutely,
like that?
Mm. Absolutely. Now, I must take off from there. I'm coming back to Auschwitz again, but you've put me on a point. My father was a commission rank in the 1418 war. My father was, as I said, one of the finest Christians I've ever made. He was a practicing Christian. Very big, strong man, great athlete, great footballer. But he did such a lot for people. A tremendous amount. He bought the old boys little radio sets, and he used to go and cut their hair, and when he couldn't get, little villages, you know, and then when they couldn't, to try and clean them up and things like that. He used to pay their rates for them, as I found out after he died. Now, as I say, I was abroad quite early, and I realised he used to think the world of me, although he never ever uttered it to me, ever in his life. Because I'd gone abroad, and because of that, he volunteered. He put his age down. A farmer, he put his age down and volunteered. He got, all they would accept him in was the, oh heavens, food and ammunition convoys. Who were the people that used to? He was in there.
Yeah.
And they got him in the Crete. I didn't know anything about this. And when he was in Africa, apparently he was looking for me all over the shop. He asked and asked and asked. I didn't know. I didn't know he was in the army. And my dear mother must have been absolutely out of her mind. And he finally went to Crete. And he was captured. He was wounded pretty badly. And he was captured by parachutists when they parachuted into Crete. And he was taken prisoner, and I didn't know it. He was wounded badly. He got double pneumonia. And he was dragged to work. He was dragged to work on a railway. Snow, he dragged through the snow. His comrades used to drag. They insisted. And they said what he used to do is sit there with the nuts and bolts, you know, they used to bolt the rail, and throw them over the mountainside and things like that. And he got very severely beaten with it for that. And then, thank God, he survived the war and got back to England. But that's another story. That's indeed another story altogether.
So you would have both been in captivity at the same time, yes, I suppose,
yes,
would you?
Yes. I heard in the latter part, the last letter I got, I realised, I found out that my father was a POW. And that's all. That's all.
Did you hear from home at all?
Pardon?
Did you hear from your mother?
You know, oh, yes. Yes, indeed. I must come to that. Now, the dreadful things that were happening in Auschwitz, as you know, there were burning thousands. There were people that couldn't live anymore because of their strength or failing and Lord knows what. They were gassed, as you know. You know the old story of it.
What did you know, though, at the time?
Oh, I knew a lot
about
it. You
know, forget what I know. You tell me what you knew was going on there.
Well, I knew practically everything that was going on there. I knew that from all over the continent, people were being brought to Auschwitz. Men, women, children, old people were being brought to Auschwitz-Birkenau and other camps. And they were sorted out, and some were gassed right away. There were heaps and heaps of clothing, glasses, footwear, shoes, huge warehouses full of them from these people. They'd taken all the clothes from and spectacles and what have you, and just put them into the gas chambers and used the Zyklon B or Zyklon B. And then they were burned. And this happened day in and day out. And then they said, the people of Germany didn't know what was going on. The people of Auschwitz itself complained bitterly about the smell from the crematoria. They were complaining about this daily. And all these people coming in cattle trucks, there must have been hundreds of thousands of Germans that saw them. And yet they said, no, no, we didn't know a damn thing that was happening. Well, that's ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Anyway, this is a fact. Women, particularly old women and children, were killed, and the best of the menfolk were allowed to live. The rest were gassed and burned daily, 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 daily.
Did you see any of this, you know?
Oh, no, I never saw the burning of it.
No, how did you get your information? You know, I'm wondering when it first came home to you.
I'll tell you that, exactly. Whilst working in Egefarben, it was quite apparent what was going on. These people were totally underfed. They looked ghastly. And the treatment of them by the Waffen-SS was horrific. Horrific, to say the least. Daily, on a daily basis. For nothing at all, they would kill somebody. They would strike them down and maim them, and things like that. For nothing. Nothing at all. That was the Waffen-SS. And how I knew it, there was a fellow working alongside me, Ernst, and he was a very educated, young boy. He was a German Jew. Now, it was absolutely forbidden to talk to these Jews, although you absolutely, ganz verboten. But we did. We conversed, and he told me, whilst over days, you must understand, very protracted information I got, he had a sister that came, fortunately got out of Germany in 1939, was in Birmingham, and he knew the address, and it was in here. Now, I couldn't speak to this Sherpa any length of time. I wanted all the information possible. So over the days and weeks, we arranged to have an umtaushan, an exchange. I went in to Birkenau with Ernst. And this Stripey got into my uniform and got into E715 for the night. And I went with him to Birkenau and slept alongside him, as was this position of this other fellow. And in this way, I got the information, very surreptitiously again. And it appeared that he gave me the address of his sister and the name she adopted, Cottrell, Susan Cottrell. And we were allowed letters every now and again. This was in early 44. We were allowed letters early on, every now and again. Not any length of time evolved between, but suddenly we'd get a letter. Now, when my sister and I were kids, we used to have a code at home, a simple little code at home. We used to write and leave messages for each other that mother wouldn't know about, you know. And I effected this code. And I wrote to my mother, and I used for numbers our dairy herd, the number of our dairy herd at that time, to any power, to the power of 4 or 5 or 6. Do you understand? To get the numbers. And the numbers of people that were gassed every day. And I got this message through to her. And she eventually dropped in. And my sister, fortunately, she used to fly during the war, incidentally. She was ferrying planes from America. She was with the Amy Johnson's crowd.
Yes, I know, the women ferry pilots.
That's right. She used to ferry planes. And she cottoned on to this with her mother. And in that way, they got the basic information. Then I sent this address of a friend of mine in England, you know, which nobody would recognise. She got in touch with her, and she fed her the information about Germany, what they were doing. And she tied this up with this code message, this basic little code that I used to tell her about. And my mother got all this information. She wrote to the War Office on two occasions, because no one knew of it there. She didn't get one word of acknowledgement. Not one letter of acknowledgement at all. Would you believe this? However, that's something of nothing. And as a result, I was able to ask my mother to send cigarettes and ask Susan to send cigarettes to me, if that were possible. Because there were devil of a lot of stealing of mail and what have you. And this is the reason why there is such a paucity of Red Cross parcels. And these, incidentally, were our lifeblood. Without those, I couldn't have lived, nor could any of us have lived without those. And they used to come every now and again, just about enough to keep us off the breadline, so to speak. Because the food they used to give us was ghastly. Oh, it's treacherous stuff. You couldn't eat it without being sick or diarrhea or dysentery or God knows what.
Can you think what they did give you? What
only black bread and coffee in the morning, ersatz, and soup at night. And this was like a cabbage soup or mango soup. No sustenance in it at all. But We were, thank you very, very much. We were, I must admit, we were a lot better treated than the Stripies. A lot better. The SS used to turn their backs on us 9 times out of 10, but the Wehrmacht used to treat us as well as could be expected. They used to have their moments, of course. And I must tell you of a moment. No, I will tell you about the Red Cross parcels and the cigarettes that got us. We used to do a lot of bartering with the civil population. We used to work inside there. And we're able to do, I mean, for a cigarette, it was fantastic what you could get, egg and an egg for one cigarette. It was incredible. The exchange was incredible. And at one time, a fellow of us, we were counted. The thing was, we were counted out into a Gefarben. Then at night, we were counted again, marched back to the E715, and then searched and counted, and then put through into your barracks, for want of a better word, barracks. And it's on this occasion, I wasn't carrying anything at all, and this chappie, he was searched, I was searched, and then they found something. And right between his legs, inside his trousers, and down inside his leg of his trousers, was the scrawny chicken that he'd finally got. Well, when the guards found this, they went berserk. And of course, they never hit one person. They take the immediate people around, which I was one, and they started slashing around, and they slung us into a bunker. That is a little oublier, if you like. And without food, without anything. And it was freezing, absolutely freezing. It was below zero, well below zero. Next morning, we were taken out, four guards with cocked rifles, and one Feldwebel with a pistol, and that was cocked as well, in front of the Hauptmann, the officer, the chief man. And he looked at me and he said, "Where did you get this chicken?" I just looked at him. "Where did you get this chicken? How did you get this chicken?" And this, he was a cockney. And he said, "Well, sir, I was working very hard for the German country, the German people, in Ego Farm, working very, very hard. And this chicken came along the road and attacked me. And I couldn't do anything. I had to kill it in self-defense." I've never known a silence in my life like it. It was bump. So everything could, all the doors had dropped down. And then it seemed an endless time. And he started laughing. And he nearly fell off his chair. Then all the guards started. And it was uproarious. It was incredible. And then it just swept us out. And that saved that civilian person's life. That. Now, would you think about that? I didn't think about it. It was this cockney. I'll never forget him. Poor fellow was killed eventually in Auschwitz. Never forget it as long as I live. That. Anyway, that was the sort of situation that one had to do to get stuff in, you know. You took a hell of a chance, but there again, and you took a hell of a chance because they would have tried to screw the information out of you of where you got it and who gave it to you, because that is definitely sabotage against the the Regierung, yeah, the Deutsche, the German people and the German country as such. That was it, but I must admit, we lived, if you take the stripies as a common denominator, we lived pretty well. But nevertheless, we didn't live so bad. We didn't live too well. I mean, during my stay there of 18 months, I had forgot my disease.
Typhus.
I got typhus, and there was very little medication there, and I was kept outside in an open trench, just because of, you know, because typhus is, and you know how it comes through the what's the bug?
The lice.
Lice, yes. Yeah. But I consider myself exceptionally fortunate. And I came out of that. God knows how I did it, but I did. And that was it. And I got back reasonably to health. And that was it. And
how about your eye? You know, when you were hit across your face with a rifle.
No, with a Luger pistol.
Yes.
Pistol weapon.
Did you have any treatment for that?
Oh, yes, I got treatment by our own people, our own medic. There was a Captain Harrison. He was the medical officer. God knows how he came there. He was the only person that could help any of us. Now, I've seen reports that there's supposed to have been a revere there, like a hospital, little hospital for beds and no such thing. And that Captain Harrison had all the medical gear that was possible. No, he didn't. He didn't hardly had a thing. All he had was a panacea, which was a little 40 watt lamp, I think, in a little holder that if you got bruises or anything like that, you were hit, bruised or cut, he used to put this heat over it, and that's all the treatment that we got. Although I've seen results, reports made after the war, that we had all the medicine possible, and it was totally, totally wrong. but what can I say further?
What was the organisation of the British POWs in Auschwitz? You know, hears about the Stalag system.
Well, the situation was, apparently, that the main Stalags were responsible for the various encampments around different places people were sent to, mines, sugar beet factories, and agricultural workers. They were ostensibly in charge of that. But there was no such thing. There was no such thing as control over Auschwitz, over Monowitz. None at all. There was supposedly to be a man of confidence there. The man of confidence being Charlie Card, who was a CSM. And we used to call him the Count of Auschwitz. If ever there was a con man, he was. He was for us and against us, if you like. He worked very well with the Germans. He was like that, sour, very much. And but nevertheless, he, on the other hand, I must admit, he did help quite a bit in talking to the Hauptmann and what have you. And he wasn't able to get us anything, but he talked to him and made it a reasonably quiescent life. Except, you know, when you're knocked up in the morning with a rifle butt, rouse, get up, you know, and get on out on parade and that sort of thing. But he was sent back, and there was no such man of confidence as such. And I've seen reports since, and I've seen it. I've got a copy of a report in there which I'll show you. The very fact that they had all this control, how they had a Red Cross convention, meetings and visits and Lord knows what. There was no such thing. We never had one visit. And I particularly had my ears to the ground most of the time. In point of fact, we had ferrets inside there. You know what ferrets are? They're people who put there by the Germans. And we found one chappie out entirely. And he was disposed of.
Who was
very
he?
Effectively, and the Germans didn't respond to that at all.
Yes, who was he? The one, the ferret you found. Can you say who he was?
He was the chappie purporting to come from the Greenhard Regiment. Well, he was a silly arse, really, because he shouldn't have said it was the Greenhard, because there were very few Greenhards in captivity. And we found he was very suspect by his attitude and not his speech. His speech was very good. He had an Oxford accent, if you can call that accent Oxford. But he was very suspect right from the start, and we found out there was a lot of information getting out, particularly. And we then got people to talk to him, and we found out we got a message sent back to Lambsdorff by a very surreptitious way. It was really, really good. And we found out that there was no such name as that man. And then we had a discussion with ourselves, and then we brought in three men. They were told exactly what to do, and they did it. And he's ostensibly down, you know, what we used to call the lavatory department. And his body is still there, as far as I know. And the Germans didn't respond at all, but he was definitely a ferret. Because what he didn't know colloquialisms and vernacular. That was it. That was where it called him out. And lots of little things, you know, that one normally English people talk about. And in this way, you know, he was found out quite effectively. But this is the trick they tried. Then they tried propaganda. They've tried it in so many, many ways. Our uniforms were pretty grim. And then suddenly, out of the blue, came these uniforms. They were purported to have come from Red Cross, I don't know. They never were. They couldn't have been. And obviously they were uniforms that had been, I suppose the Germans had captured them or something, you know. And we got new uniforms, which was fantastic because we were filthy work. And that was very nice. Then they wanted to take photographs. Well, we didn't mind. We had these new uniforms. So who can look that sort of thing in the face? You know, why should you anyway? We weren't hurting at all. No one was gaining anything from us. So this is very, very nice. About a week after that, we were asked about football. Do any of you chappies play football and whatever, like in conversation? Yes. Would you like to play football? Well, we haven't got any time to play football. I think every third Sunday we got off. Every third Sunday. Other words, 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. Yes, we would. We would like to play football. We haven't got any gear. We will supply the gear. So then we decided, we thought about it and said, well, look here. They would only allow us four matches. So we said, let's make this an international. So we had an England team, a Scottish team, a Welsh team, and a South African team. And we more or less effected, an idea of what each other, what could do in football and whatever. And some very good footballers amongst our crowd. I used to play for the South Africans. I'll show you a photograph after. And we had four matches, and the South Africans won. There were only two South Africans represented.